It's an honor to be here today in front of everybody. And something Kevin Danaher said this morning, it's time to start listening to the youth. Because we are the future, and we are now carrying the torch of freedom and speaking and taking responsibility for all life everywhere. And we stand up here in front of you on behalf of the youth. And it's an honor to be working with the ancestors on this and the elders. I won't say anything more. Open your hearts, take a look around and see. Times are changing, children want to be free. Children aware, children not scared. Times are changing all around the world. While the government is lying, more children are dying. They forgot we are the future, 'cause money made them blind. Change is not easy, no, change is hard. But together we can change it, just by doing our part. We are the children.
I thought that was appropriate because this panel is going to be something completely different also. We're going to be dealing with some aspects of globalization that are not usually included in these discussions. Be less about direct horror stories about the World Bank and more about the big systems that are also parallel to it. I do want to ask if anyone has lost a passport. We have found a passport. And if you've lost a passport, please go to the will call table outside, and we have it for you. And identify yourself. So this panel's on the technological dimension, economic globalization, as we've been hearing for 5 hours so far today, depends upon strong central bureaucracies like the WTO, the World Bank. Should we let people settle down a little bit here? Depends upon strong central bureaucracies like the World Bank and the IMF to make and enforce rules that can control, organize, reorganize, redesign the behavior and the structures of nation states so that they become subordinate to corporate free trade. The eventual goal is for all states to adopt identical ideologies, economic ideologies, and identical cultural values, have all of their systems integrated like a standard gauge railway, so there are no obstacles at all to the onset of corporate free trade. As my colleague Andy Kimbrell likes to say, the goal is total control. This is what everybody's been so eloquently talking about all morning today, and you'll hear a lot more about it this evening on tonight's panels. But now we're going to shift gears for something different because it's also crucial to the globalization issue that we consider some of these other areas. The kind of total control that they desire is not really going to be possible from the bureaucracies alone. It also requires technological systems of appropriate scale, reach, power, and centralizations, appropriate to make global corporations primary, viable as the primary actors they are now and seek to be even more. You also need a convincing way to speak into the minds of billions of ordinary people on the planet, to persuade them that what you've designed for them is the best of all possible worlds, and that corporations are the right institutions to run things. Telecommunications, of course, is very good for that job. It offers the chance via television and other media to speak to the whole world at the same time, like some kind of virtual big brother, and nicely lends itself to central corporate control, as we'll hear a lot more about later. But finally, just in case all that doesn't work out, there's always force. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, this country's number one cheerleader for globalization, put it extremely well. Quote, "The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley technology is called the United States Army." So the purpose of this panel is to take a short time out from the kind of in-depth exploration of the iron triangle of bureaucracies we've been hearing about, to have a look at the technological dimensions of these subjects, the technical systems that further globalization, and the military that protects it. About 2 years ago, right here in Washington at Lisner Auditorium, which I believe is now a locked-out, no-protest zone, we had a teach-in on globalization. Those were the dark old days when it was still hard to get 500 people to show up for anti-globalization events, never mind 50,000 on the streets. But we plugged forward and featured a great debate between our side and theirs. Our side was John Kavanagh, Maud Barlow, and Vandana Shiva. You'll hear them all tonight. And their side featured some of Free Trade's greatest advocates, notably Joe Cobb of the right-wing Heritage Foundation. Our side won the debate, of course, but Joe Cobb made a very telling point. Responding to the question of whether globalization was inevitable, he answered, "Well, probably globalization could have been stopped a few years ago, but technology has made it inevitable." A few days later, I heard the same remark quoted from Dr. Claude Smadja of the World Economic Forum in Davos. He used the same words. Globalization is inevitable because of technology. Of course, the first question is, how come the right-wingers are so onto that analysis while the rest of us are still kind of celebrating technology? But anyway, I'll leave that hanging for now. Joe Cobb was probably thinking about the telecommunications revolution, but he could also have been thinking about other technologies that have global impact. The automobile, for example. It's surely made the world smaller. It's homogenized landscapes everywhere on Earth. It's caused intense corporate focus on more and more resources, wherever on earth they are, meaning greater free trade access, and finding more and more markets, meaning greater free trade access, and ever cheaper labor, thus the tremendous interest right now in China. Cars have also brought us oil wars, where the global military gets engaged, as in Iraq and some believe in Kosovo, but we'll come back to that. Cobb could as well have been speaking about robotics or automation, which is replacing workers at an alarming rate in all economic sectors, not only here, but in third world contexts as well. We're used to hearing the complaints that labor is losing jobs to third world workers, but now, even in new high-tech facilities being built by U.S. companies in Asia, workers are losing jobs to no workers. And the situation will quickly get worse as corporate consolidation and giantism bring further economies of industrial scale. Cobb could have been talking about the globalization of high-tech industrialization in mining or forestry or the large dams funded by the IMF and World Bank, as we've heard of so much of today. All of these are examples of the fabulous new technologies that can rip apart forests and landscapes at unprecedented rates and are perfectly suited for large-scale corporate investment and exploitation. All of these have been directly served by the investment rules of the WTO and the loan policies of the World Bank and the IMF. The IMF and the World Bank strongly favor large-scale industrial solutions to poverty, even though all evidence suggests it doesn't relieve poverty, it increases it and destroys nations' abilities to achieve self-reliance, even in the areas of food production, where many nations formerly had it. A great illustration is in agriculture. In most of the world, small farmers had until recently been feeding their families and communities with locally grown, diverse staple food crops. But now the bank, IMF, and WTO, and the big global ag corporations are saying small farmers are not efficient enough. In the United States, 99.5% of homes have television sets. 95% of people watch some television every day. The average home has a TV set going for about 8 hours, even if no one is watching. The average adult viewer actually watches about 4 hours daily. The average child under 12 is watching about 3 hours. These are amazing statistics when you think about them. It means that half the population may be watching more than 4 hours. How's that even possible? They watch on weekends all day. People watch more TV in the U.S. than they do anything else besides sleep or work or go to school. TV's replaced community, it's replaced family, it's replaced the environment. It is the environment. We are the first society to have moved inside media, with apparently serious consequences to health, personal alienation, knowledge of basic information, and so on. You have to say, the main thing Americans do is watch television. If you were a Martian anthropologist sent to study Earth people and hovered over the U.S., you'd have to report back something like this. They sit night after night after night in dark rooms. They're staring at a light. Their eyes are not moving. They're not thinking. Their brains are in a passive receptive state. And images are pouring into their brains from thousands of miles away from someplace they are not. The whole thing looks like a massive experiment in mind control, they might say. And that's exactly what it is. This average television viewer in the United States is seeing about 23,000 commercials per year. That's 23,000 repetitions of exactly the same message, delivered in extremely powerful imagery, basically saying the same thing. One may say toothpaste, and one may say cars, but the intent of every one of those 23,000 messages is identical, to get people to view life as a nonstop string of commodity satisfactions. Around the world, most industrialized countries have similar habits. Even the less developed world is saturated with TV, usually delivered by satellite systems. The last time I checked, nearly 80% of the global population that's what we need is make love, not TV. Nearly 80% of the global population had access to TV, most of it with advertising, and very high percentage of it from the United States and Western countries. And heavy viewing is the norm. All over the world, on icy tundras or in grass houses in Borneo or in places where there are not even roads, people are sitting together watching a bunch of white people in Dallas standing around their swimming pools, drinking martinis, and plotting how to steal from each other. A very high percentage of the content throughout the world is still old reruns of American shows, sitcoms, LA cop shows, or Baywatch, the most popular show in America in history. Or else it's CNN, that cultural cultural diversity institution. The next question, of course, is who's sending these images? Who's deciding what kind of images goes into the brains of the whole world's population? I'm going to leave that answer to Bob McChesney and Mark Miller, because they're the experts in it. You see a chart here to prove everything they say. But I will step on their lines enough to mention that right now, the vast majority of global television imagery, as well as entertainment imagery and film imagery and books and newspapers too, is sent by a truly tiny number of gigantic global corporations, notably Time Warner, Disney, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. All of them are getting bigger and bigger with each passing day through mergers and consolidations, as we will hear. So, we have the preposterous and terrifying situation of a handful of people in Hollywood and New York implanting the brains of the entire world population with a fantastically concentrated and nonstop dose of powerful images that tell them to hate where they live, love Los Angeles, and believe that buying stuff is the only way to live, and to worship McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and corporations as the answer to their problems. Okay, that's television. That's the old technology. Now we have computers. We have the internet. Now we're free and involved and interactive. We can network with each other and get organized and mold reality to our wishes. But is the internet really our technology? Or, as Joe Cobb seems to think, is it theirs? The ultimate politics of the computer revolution is still unclear, but it's an odd revolution because on all sides, everybody's in agreement. Everybody thinks it's great. The right and the left, the corporations and the activists, the Al Gores and the Bill Clintons and the McCains and the Bushes, the engineers and the artists all express utopian visions of a new democracy and a new empowerment that computers and the internet have brought to us. But is this right? Is it really bringing us closer to democracy or equity? Or is it the opposite? How should we be addressing this point? Wired magazine says that the computer revolution has created an entirely new political structure on the planet. The symbol of today should no longer be the atom, they say. It should be the web or the net. According to this view, the political center has been wiped out by the internet, and an entirely new web structure has emerged that, quote, elevates the power of the small player, unquote, while promoting heterogeneity and a new kind of pure democracy where all are equal players in the global information game. It also brings a new techno-spiritualism, says Wired. Okay, on that last point, techno-spiritualism. Judging by the amount of time people are ritually engaged with their computers, I would say we've already got that techno-spiritualism. But never mind. As for the political point, that the old political center has been wiped out by our PCs and our emails and web pages, and that we're now in a new computer-enhanced democracy through cyberspace, let me ask this. Should we call that virtual democracy? I think so, because somebody forgot to tell the transnational corporations in Tokyo, New York, London, and especially Brussels and Geneva that the real power is no longer in the center and that they've lost control. Judging by all the other evidence, centralized corporate power and political power has never accelerated more rapidly than it is now, and the computer has a key role in this. Corporations now use these very same empowered technologies that we do to empower themselves massively by being able to move their stupendous assets around the world at the touch of a key and without any outside observation, causing currencies in the third world countries to be destabilized and cause massive economic infrastructure impacts that serve bankers and speculators and global corporations. So what kind of revolution have we really got here? To use terms like empowerment to summarize the effects of computers is, I think, to misunderstand power in a real political and economic context. Computers do help us as individuals, and they make us feel powerful and competent. And they're surely useful in many ways, as I totally acknowledge. And they can keep us in touch with our colleagues, and they're great for organizing and sending news around about teach-ins and so on. In my opinion, computer technology will eventually be viewed as the most centralizing instrument ever invented. For while we sit at our PCs editing our copy, sending our emails, transnational corporations are using their global networks 24 hours per day with far greater resources, faster and better machines, spread out everywhere on the planet at a scale and speed that makes our level of empowerment pathetic by comparison. In fact, the giant global corporation of today could not exist without the global computer networks to keep their 1,000-arm enterprises in touch and all of their billions of parts moving in the same direction. When they push their buttons on their computers, they're not just sending letters and information to their people. These messages cause hundreds of billions of dollars in resources to be transferred from banks in Geneva to Delhi or Sarawak with concrete results. Forests get cut down, dams get built. So truly, what kind of revolution is this? The electronic revolution has thus far had far more to offer the Joe Cobbs and their friends and the Claude Smadges and their friends than it has to you and me or us. One could even say that the technology, because of its centralizing tendency, has a globalization bias, a corporate bias, a right-wing bias, I think. So, one request. As you continue to use your computers for the very good works you are all engaged in, keep some of this in mind. And let's stop calling them empowering, because somebody else is getting more empowered than we are. Now, there's much more to say about this, and Bob McChesney and Mark Miller will expound on the truly awesome, titanic global battle now going on among a handful of giant technology companies for complete control of these technologies. And with the recent merger of Time Warner and AOL, and with digitization coming soon, we may be heading for an entire global communication system, internet, television, film, music, the whole deal, satellites, everything controlled by oligopolistic arrangements, three or four companies. Worse, they may all be the same companies. But I'm going to make one more comment on the gigantic push by this government and others to codify one aspect of this revolution, that e-commerce be tax-free globally. In my view, one of the greatest victories we had in Seattle, and the least noticed, was to beat back this idea. The U.S. was pushing hard to codify globally within the WTO that all taxes on e-commerce should be permanently banned. We call that the Bill Gates rule. But thanks to the breakdown of the WTO in Seattle, that rule never passed. But watch out, it's going to come back. If it does pass, it will be one of the greatest corporate boondoggles in history, a subsidy of astounding scale, and an absolute death blow to what are playfully called the old brick-and-mortar businesses. The retail shops and neighborhood stores, the small chains, the bookstores, already disappearing fast, the record shops, businesses that have physical presence where people actually gather. In the third world, the situation will be far worse, as those economies are nearly entirely made of small shops, direct retail, who will be placed in death competitions with global internet companies that exist, if they exist anywhere, thousands of miles away. The situation is already bad for them, but the advantage of no taxes will be the last straw. One could even surmise that it's the purpose of the Bill Gates rule to finally destroy all the old traditional economies in favor of a new globalized e-commerce system that functions on an entirely different plane with far more powerful actors. It's nothing less than an attempt to eliminate the old economic system of small producers, small retailers, small businesses, who till now have had some chance to survive, and replacing it with global internet e-commerce trade brought by corporations from thousands of miles away. The devastation to local economies that would go with this is beyond the imagination, as well as the devastation to cultures, livelihoods, and political structures of small and poor countries. So much for the internet empowering the small players. Okay. So we have the industrial forestry and agriculture revving up the takeover of small producers. We have robotics and automation eliminating industrial service jobs. We have biotechnology and life patenting making it impossible for farmers to survive. We have the whole world with its head in the television set, gathering images from three super mega corporations, cloning and homogenizing consciousness. And now we have a technology sold to us as democratic, but in practice centralizing for corporations and the ability of small countries and threatening the ability of small countries and small producers to survive. Are people going to stand for that? Maybe not. In fact, they're already protesting. We have millions of people protesting in India, hundreds of thousands in Europe, and we have tens of thousands now in the U.S., and we've barely just begun. Can we turn it around? Of course we can. But what does the military have to say about it? Which brings me to the last piece of this puzzle. One of the least known yet most important facts about the WTO is that the only sector of the international economy those lines are better than the regular ones. The only sector of the international economy that has been formally excluded from the rules of the WTO and other bureaucracies is the military. The WTO butts in on every country's social and environmental policies, but when it comes to the military, it contains a so-called security exemption. It's found in Article 21 of the GATT Agreement, which has now been folded into the WTO. The security exemption allows any and all subsidized and protections for armament development and trade. Subsidies and protections for armament development and trade. If a country says, it allows these subsidies and protections if a country says it is in its essential national interest. That's the operative phrase. This specifically includes trade in armaments, ammunition, and implements of war, which is a big hunk of the global economy. What makes Article 21 so powerful is that governments define for themselves their essential security interests, thus making it possible for them to fold all kinds of economic activity within this exemption, and thus protecting against controls or even oversight. To give you an idea of how the military sees our essential national interests, I have here a publication from the United States Space Command. It's called Vision for 2020, and it says this. Historically, military forces have evolved to protect national interests and investments, both military and economic. During the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. During the westward expansion of the United States, the cavalry emerged to protect our railroads, wagon trains, and settlements. The emergence of space power follows both of these models. U.S. space forces will protect military and commercial national interests and investment from space. And it goes on to speak about space dominance. So Thomas Friedman had it right. I know Steve Staples and Randy Forsberg will have further examples and possibly better ones to show this connection. So I'm over time. Here's my conclusion. One, the golden triangle of bureaucracies have the job to make the rules of conformity to adhere to globally centralized corporate control. Two, the technologies appropriate to global scale corporate operations are now in place, which together with the rules make voracious, vicious development possible. Three, global communication systems are homogenizing consciousness and values and offering central control of consciousness by corporations. And four, the security dimension, revving itself up to protect a global system that, as we learned in Seattle, may not be as invincible as it looks. Thanks for your attention. Apologies for going on too long. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Now, the rest of the panel is divided as follows. We have two people to talk about, more about, corporate concentration, media control, and the control of telecommunications. That would be Mark Miller and Bob McChesney. And then we have two more people who will talk about the military dimensions of this story. That would be Randall Forsberg and Steve Staples. And then Andy Kimbrell, he doesn't know what he's going to talk about. He said he'd try to sum it all up at the end. And I'm sure he will do a great job. Did we decide that Bob was going first? Yeah. So let me introduce Bob McChesney. He's a research associate professor at the Institute of Communications Research and the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author and editor of five other books, including Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy, The Battle of Control of Use of Battle for Control of U.S. Broadcasting, and with Edward Herman, The Global Media, New Missionaries of Corporate Capitalism. He has written over 100 articles, book chapters, magazine pieces. He's a former magazine publisher himself, and his new book is called Rich Media, Poor Democracy, Communication Politics in Dubious Times, and it's great. And so I strongly urge you to get hold of it. So I'm happy to introduce Bob McChesney.
I wish my parents were here. They always wanted me to go into the ministry. And they could never get me in one of these buildings as soon as I got old enough to figure out how to do these things. I'm usually brought to these conferences to be the Grim Reaper, to bring the bad news about how powerful corporate forces are, how insidious their system is, how corrupt the policymaking system is that permits them to grow so large and powerful. And people sort of see me as the guy who sort of bum everyone out. And that's really not my mission. And it won't be my mission today. I'm actually quite optimistic. But I think if you're going to change something, you have to understand how it works. You aren't doing any favor pretending something isn't as bad as it is because you don't know about it. And that's certainly the case with our global media system today. Jerry gave some nice introductory comments about television and the internet, and Mark's going to follow me, Mark Crispin Miller, and discuss in more detail some of the points I'm going to make and elaborate on others. I think there are a few points I just want to make today to bring to your attention. First of all, it's very important, I think, to understand that the rise of a global commercial media system dominated by a handful of corporations is a mandatory and necessary part of the global neoliberal economic project. It's not just a coincidence that they happen at the same time. It's not a fluke. It's a mandatory part for several reasons, but a couple I'll just point out off the top. One, you need to have a global commercial media market to establish global markets for consumer goods. That means advertising over television. That's a relatively recent phenomenon. That's the hallmark, in fact, of this emerging global media system that I'm going to be talking about. Secondly, and this is a point Jerry talked about, global commercial media is ideal at spreading a certain type of consumer ideology that's highly conducive to the type of world that's being built in the name of neoliberalism and globalization. An ideology I want to talk more about this at the end of my talk, but one that is fundamentally depoliticizing and demoralizing and anti-democratic in any fundamental respect. Now, just to go back 20 years, if you were to look at the media system in any particular nation, say in 1980, the way you would understand it would be to look at who owns the newspapers, who owns the magazines, how is the television and radio system structured. And then after you understand the lay of the land within a particular country, what you would do is you would look at how they imported movies or TV shows or music or books, and then you sort of have a feel for any given country's media system. Well, today we've seen a fundamental shift. Now, to understand the media system in any particular country, you start by understanding the global system, its logic and dynamics, and then you make variants for each country, how they veer off that path. But the dominant thing you must understand to begin with is this global commercial media system that has emerged in the past 20 years. It's rapidly developing as we speak now, and it's a key part, as I said, of the neoliberal and globalization project. Now, the one aspect of the globalization of commercial media that gets a lot of emphasis, as Jerry talked about in his presentation, is the notion of technology, that it's technology-driven, that all of a sudden we have satellites and digital communication that makes rapid transmission of data and information and media across the world much less expensive and much easier. Now, there's an element of truth to that, but it really misses the core phenomena that's going on, which is part of the neoliberal project, which has been a deregulation of ownership restrictions and requirements and public service requirements on media across the world in various nations, opening up the possibility for capitalists to move in and get larger and larger and larger in ways that simply were illegal 10 or 20 years ago in the United States, as well as most nations in the world. The central battleground where this war has taken place, where this transformation has occurred, has been in television. Television 20 years ago was largely a 2- or 3-channel operation in most countries, oftentimes state-run, sometimes non-commercial. Now, all over the world, television is a multi-channel, cable or satellite operation with scores of channels available, almost all of which are owned partially or in total by a relative handful of transnational corporations that support themselves by selling advertising. And let's talk briefly about who these guys are. Let's name some names and give you a sense of what the system looks like. This is Mark Miller's chart, and I have to confess I haven't seen it till this very moment, so I'm sharing it with you. So I'm not sure the exact details, but it looks like what Mark has done here is he's outlined five of the largest companies, five of the big nine companies that dominate the world. The last one on the list up here, you've got General Electric, which owns NBC, Time Warner, which is now part of AOL Time Warner, News Corporation, which is Rupert Murdoch's operation, the Disney Company, and CBS, which actually is in the process right now of being bought out by Viacom. So Viacom, CBS. And in addition to those five companies, the only ones you really need to add to those to get the sort of what I call the first tier of global media giants are the German company Bertelsmann, AT&T, which is the largest cable company in the United States, Sony, which has major film and music interest in the United States and globally, and Seagram, the drinks manufacturer, which also has film studios and massive music and tourist interest. And what distinguishes these nine companies, these five and the other four I mentioned, is that they operate globally and they're conglomerates. And by conglomerates, what I mean is they tend to be dominant players not just in one thing. They don't just make movies or books or television shows or make music, but they are dominant players in virtually every sector. So if you go down these lists and look what Time Warner is a player in globally, a leading film studio, number one magazine publisher, main TV show production, a book publisher, the largest cable TV channel company in the world, CNN, HBO, the whole works. The list goes on and on. Retail stores. This is what the look of the modern transnational media conglomerate looks like. To give some sense of how rapidly the system has grown as a result of deregulation, take a company like Viacom CBS. 11 years ago, Viacom was a fairly small company that did approximately $600 million in business. This year, Viacom CBS will do approximately $22 billion in business. That's extraordinarily fast growth. And that's paralleled by most of the other firms that are up here. They're really recently put together through mergers, a number of mergers and acquisitions. And among these nine, those five companies and the other four I mentioned, you have all the major Hollywood film studios, all the U.S. television networks. You have the four companies that now sell 90% of the music in the world. You have most of the book publishers, or a significant percentage of them, in the United States and in the world for that matter. I mean, you've really got the guts of much of the production of our cultures in the hands of these nine companies. Now, to be accurate, though, that's not the entire media system. There are a lot of other companies that are players, and I'm going to talk about those in a second. But before I turn to those, I want to make one other point about these nine companies. As tight-knit as this is, with just nine massive firms that sit atop it, it doesn't really give you the full sense of how interconnected these companies are. One of the things these large companies have learned, and I guess we're among friends here, aren't we, Jerry? I've got a secret I want to tell you. Bill Gates asked me not to tell anyone this, but I'm going to let it out of the bag. You've probably heard this rumor that capitalism is based on competition. Have you heard that one? That's a doozy. Well, the fact of the matter is capitalism is based on crushing competition. The less competition you have, the lower your risk, the more profit you make. Only a moron capitalist wants competition. That's ridiculous. Well, these nine companies are the smart brand of capitalists, the kind who make a lot of money. And so what they do, in addition to having these massive empires and largely non-competitive oligopolistic markets, is that when they go into new ventures, what they attempt to do is to partner up with potential competition before they go into it, what's called an equity joint venture. And if you go through the nine largest media firms in the world, these transnationals, they have at least one joint venture with seven of the other eight. Someone like Rupert Murdoch has numerous joint ventures with all of them. And it creates a very different dynamic. The head of John Malone, the founder of TCI, which was sold to AT&T, put it well. He said, it's hard to get angry at your competition anymore because you compete in one market and your partner's in another market. It's a small group of people. So, I mean, this is the point. It's a tight-knit club of massive corporations owned by billionaires in service primarily to Madison Avenue and upper-middle-class consumers. Now, the second tier of the global media system consists of about 70 firms or so, maybe 80. You can pick the number you want. And these tend to be companies that are not global powerhouses. They don't tend to have film studios, but they tend to be newspaper powers, or they might be cable companies, or they might be local regional dynamos in a particular country or part of the world. Most of these 70 companies are going to come from Europe and from North America. And a handful of them, though, come from the rest of the world, Japan in particular, but across Asia and into Latin America. Now, the second tier of media companies is very closely linked to the first tier. They're not in an adversarial relationship whatsoever. In fact, the success of the second tier oftentimes, especially in what are called the third world countries, depends on close relations with these guys. They oftentimes partner with them. So a company like Globo in Brazil, Televisa in Mexico, is hardly like an opponent of the global media process. It's a main player and victor in it. There's no place to look if you're trying to find support for principled opposition to the system. So what's the nature of this system in terms of content? Mark Miller will talk about that at some length. I just want to mention a couple of points that I think are worth noting. First of all, and what I think has to always be remembered, is there's a tremendous class bias built into this system, a tremendous class bias. And it's most prevalent. It's based on a market, which is $1, one vote. And in egalitarian societies, that means people with dollars get the votes. But in most, it's most telling in the journalism that this system produces. Watch CNN, watch Fox News Channel, and they all have global versions, which are basically the same thing, but even worse in many respects. And what you see is a news that's framed at the upper middle class, at investors, at people's stock portfolios. The working class has been entirely written out of the picture. They don't even exist in that world. It's a world for investors. It's a news that's completely worthless in any profound sense for a democratic society, but it's ideal for maximizing profit and preserving the status quo. Perhaps the single worst area for the commercial news media to cover, interestingly enough, is the issues we're talking about today. Globalization, the World Trade Association, IMF, World Bank. There's a reason for this. The corporate media are so closely implicated in this system that it's impossible for them to understand why anyone could criticize it. Because they're the number one beneficiaries of all these deals. They're the ones who see these markets opening up for them to sell their products and to move production around the world. So the idea that people would oppose globalization seems bizarre. Just doesn't make a lot of sense. And indeed, the sources of these news channels that Time Warner and Rupert Murdoch own, their primary sources for their news are all in agreement, too. This is a great thing. So when they go out to talk to their standard sources on issues like the IMF or World Bank, they're all saying, yeah, pretty good thing. I don't know what the story is here. It's a very difficult story for them to cover because they're not built into the structure to deal with it in any sort of balanced way whatsoever, any sort of honest manner. Now, for a long time, I would talk to journalists, and I'd say, why aren't you covering things like globalization? Why aren't you covering the IMF, the World Bank? And they would say to me, well, you know, Bob, we're professional journalists, and if we cover this, it'll be like editorializing it. We can only cover a story if there's a news hook, if there's some legitimacy that goes with the story. So then we can go to our editor and say, we want to cover this because there's a meeting, so we're covering it. And then we can raise the issues of globalization. And I said, okay, fine, sure. But then along comes Seattle. Now they've got their news hook. Now, finally, they've got the reason to go to their editors at Fox, at CNN, at MSNBC, and say, look, we've got demonstrations. We've got these huge meetings. Now let's really examine these issues of globalization. Let's really get to the bottom of this. Let's do journalism on this issue. Now, by conventional standards, this is a go issue. So that's a real test. Now we finally get the moment of truth for the corporate news media and their coverage of these issues. And what do we get? Well, I'll tell you a story that I think encapsulates what we got. But first, to put it in the right context, I want to take you back to last July, when every television set in America spent 2 weeks looking like an aquarium as we were looking for some plane at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And as our news services were discussing the trials and tribulations of a private citizen who might have died and treating this as if the Messiah had somehow left the planet and that we were on the lookout for him. Just keep that 2 weeks of nonstop, around-the-clock coverage of the incident in your mind, as I describe what I'm about to tell you now, about this small issue of the World Trade Organization, globalization of the economy and the future of our species, just so you can get the right balance. It's Wednesday night during the Seattle demonstrations. The labor demonstration is just taking place. 40,000 workers, labor members, rallying in the streets of Seattle. My good friend John Nichols, who's covering the event for The Nation or The Progressive, calls me up from Seattle. He says, Bob, you will not believe what's going on here. It's the greatest demonstration I've seen in 20 years. This is the vitality here. It's extraordinary. So I get so excited. I said, this is great. I got to turn on the TV news to what they're doing. So I turn on CNN. And, you know, there's the Inside the Beltway gang or whatever that show is. They're talking about something important. Then I turn it over to CNBC, and Geraldo is doing something important there. No Seattle. So I'm sort of getting down on my luck, and I turn it to the Fox News Channel, owned by Rupert Murdoch. And then a breakthrough. Those big letters come across the screen, breaking story. You know, in the classical music, dump-a-dump-a-dump. And then there's a picture of a guy in the background under an umbrella and a trench coat, and it's wet. I say, it's got to be Seattle. I say, hold it, John, this is great. We're finally getting some coverage of the story here. So I crank up the volume, and I couldn't make up what I'm about to tell you. I don't have that good of an imagination. The reporter goes, yes, we've got a breaking story here. The parents of JonBenet Ramsey have been seen eating at the local mall tonight. And I can say no more. I say no more. I rest my case. Now, in a more broad sense, back to the Joel General corporate news media and the corporate media in general, I mean, the fundamental thing to understand is that the globalization process, or what's called neoliberalism, is not just an economic enterprise. It's not an economic enterprise simply in the sense that they want to give business all the power and take the power away from everyone else. It's also a political exercise. Neoliberalism is a political philosophy as well as an economic philosophy. And in neoliberalism, and the way to read Milton Friedman, the guru of neoliberalism, read his famous book, Capitalism. Friedman's quite honest about it. He lays it right out for you in chapter one. Democracy is for suckers. In neoliberalism, the ideal political solution is one in which you have formal elections, but in which no one cares about politics, in which the bulk of the society is depoliticized and demoralized, and all they do is put all the energy into consumption and into market relations and commercial activity. No energy into public life, social life, or civic life. That's the dream scenario for neoliberalism. And what our corporate commercial media system does is it generates exactly the sort of culture that's most conducive to producing a neoliberal political system. That's why conservatives and neoliberals are so adamant, and not just conservatives, small C, but liberals too within our political structure, are so adamant about the spread of the corporate commercial media because it generates the ideal and necessary culture that you need to accompany this sort of neoliberal business uberalis world. Now, the logic of my argument to conclude is that if you take what I say seriously, and I hope you do, and I'm sure you do, in fact, the struggle to democratize our media, to reclaim our culture, has to be a mandatory part of our broader struggle to democratize our societies. It's simply inescapable. And that's why in our organizing activities, we've got to organize around issues of opening up our media, breaking up these big companies, preserving nonprofit and non-commercial spaces, making them healthy, viable, and dominant in our society. That should be our goal. And I want to end finally. I want to end finally by simply saying that part of the reason I'm optimistic is that I get a chance to give talks like this, usually much longer, to 40 or 50 groups a year in the U.S., oftentimes not academic groups, usually not. And there's been a real change, I think, in people's thinking. I've talked to church groups and labor groups, Kiwanis clubs. Anyone will have me. You know, when people hear about these issues and talk about them, I think there's a genuine, a lot of sentiment in our behalf. A lot of people understand that we've got real problems in this country and globally, that the sort of the commercial carpet bombing we're doing of children in this country is absolutely obscene and has to stop. It's simply unacceptable. And I could go on with other things that will stimulate people to also get excited. The most important thing to understand, though, is this is something we can organize around. These are tangible issues in people's lives. They experience this daily. The average American, what, 12 hours a day with media, I think it is now? They're consuming it. They see the journalism. They see what's happening to their children. It's an issue we can and we must organize around. It's a necessary part of a progressive platform to democratize our societies. Thank you.